omnipotent voice of the conductor.
Well, tonight's music actually begins in the morning. It begins with dawn. And the music of Mussorgsky, which is a little teeny tiny tone poem that vividly describes the sun rising over the Moscow River. You can hear the sun rising in the violas, and then it goes over to the flute, and then just to be totally corny about it, the sunlight is shimmering on the water over here, and the tremolo violins. You'll notice a lot of tremolo in this first little piece. In fact, it's a bit exhausting to sustain so much tremolo for even a few minutes. It's a delightful little piece that begins so quietly, it almost sneaks in and ends the same way, sneaks away. Hopefully you won't quite know when the music is truly stopped. But in the middle, the sun warms us up enough that we get a really soulful and expressive, beautiful melody played by our wonderful principal oboist, Ava. I don't know if you're out here already, Ava, but you sound great. And it's echoed by the string section later in the piece in the full sweep of the sound of the horns and the timpani, and even the tam-tam warms up a little bit. And some of the material I read about this piece used a wonderful frame of reference for that moment in the music where the horns burst out with their sunshine. It's like the sun striking those gold-topped domes of church buildings in Moscow, making that brilliant reflection. It's a wonderful little piece and a nice little setup for our main event of the first half, Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet. Although it's a story set in Italy, we're giving it a very Russian introduction. and it certainly has the character and personal stamp of Prokofiev, who tells Shakespeare's tale really through the intent and the emotional life of every character in the story, particularly Romeo and the evolution of his music into the love themes later in the ballet. The second suite tells parts of our story. It begins with the most violent eruption of orchestral dissonance I can think of in music. And that clearly represents extreme painful conflict, an absolute anger and hatred between the two families. And the residue of that outburst foreshadows the tragic events of the play. And what follows, in the ballet itself, that is the moment when the Duke comes out and declares that these two families shall not merge and have no contact and no association. But he uses it to begin the music of the second suite, and it leads us into the Montagues and Capulets music. And here we are introduced to some of the characteristics of Prokofiev's music that are truly unique. I often say this about composers, they have their own voice. Each one is unique and different from the other, but Prokofiev really stands out in a singular, unique voice. I can't think of another composer who sounds like him. When you become familiar enough with his music, even if you're hearing a piece of his that you don't know, you know it's Prokofiev. And the reason for that is how he composes melody. He's really is it proper to say it, melodist? he's a melody maker. And he uses these melodies thematically to represent character. So the first melody you'll hear is a perfect example of how wide-ranging his melodies are. It starts very low, leaps very high, and descends again. It's very angular, very aggressive, very arrogant, representing the superiority and arrogance of the Capulet clan. This is that melody. It's very militaristic. background comes in as well. And you can hear it, it leaps up at least one octave and later leaps up two octaves. And this is a feature of many of the melodies that Prokofiev writes. They tend to be wide-ranging in range and angular in their construction. Next, we meet the wonderful and richly complex character of Juliet. So intricate is her character. She needs three themes. And the first one is, it's Prokofiev has managed to encapsulate what I would call the puberty brain. If any of you have raised teenagers or been a teenager or spent any time with teenagers, you will immediately identify with this feeling and this theme. It starts with a little C major scale that rises up very, very quickly, and then a little bit later, it's in C sharp major and descends. The changes are very quick, very sudden. The punctuation, the little accents here and there with short notes are spontaneous sounding and abrupt. You can get the image of what's happening in the ballet right away. Juliet is, it's all youth and exuberance. She doesn't want to get dressed for the ball, and she's running away from her nursemaid and refusing to comply. This is her first introduction, her first theme. And then soon afterwards, right on the heels of that theme, is another theme that's quite different. It's much more horizontal, much more lyrical in its shape, and questioning, searching for something, the beginnings of a hint of longing for something more. Forming adult theme, where clearly she's developing into a full-blooded adult human with passion, with desire, with longing, with reaching towards something she hasn't experienced yet, that she does not know. And this music is represented in this last theme, which becomes so important throughout the course of the ballet. You'll hear it again later in the last two movements of the work as the tragedy gets closer and closer and she anticipates her own fate. This theme returns altered a little bit each time, reflecting more of what's happened to her in her story. Highest strings, and he'll take instruments that normally have a low or medium voice and have them play way up in the treble clef. Tonight you're going to see the basses way up here on the fingerboard and the cellos way up here, up in the treble clef, which creates this lovely sort of straining sound in an instrument reaching past itself, the way he brings characters out reaching past themselves. So in Friar Lawrence, he uses the depths of the orchestra at putting a melodic line in the tuba, underscored by the basses, the lowest notes in the harp, pizzicato strings, and the primary melody played by a bassoon. And it might seem a little ho-hum, a little pedantic, but I find the music to be deliberately weighted in this way. It reflects to me his conviction, his faith, his devotion to his faith, and the repetition of these quarter note, quarter note, quarter note motion in the theme, I think captures the ritual effect of prayer or chant. And you'll even hear a moment where he stops for a moment and bows before his cross. So here is Friar Lawrence's first theme. It clearly represents his compassion for them. And in that theme, you can't really hear it in the recording, but there's bass drum on every note. And there's something about the way Prokofiev uses percussion in this piece. It's not just, here's the beginning and the end, punctuation, or sort of a color added. The bass drum is like the heart and soul of each critical moment. The timpani at one point hopefully will get right through to your spine, through the front of your breastbone. And each of these instruments is as critical as any melodic line that's heard tonight. Finally, we get to the really meaty portions of this second suite. Romeo and Juliet at parting, the fifth movement, is after they've been together all night, they wake just before dawn. Romeo has been banished because he killed Tybalt, and they have to say goodbye. And the music begins so quietly, just in the earliest hours of the morning before sunrise. And soon, when he gets up to leave, they declare their love with another one of these themes that begins with stepwise motion, but then shoots up and shoots down. One can imagine the kind of physicality that would go with that on the stage in the ballet. This is the love theme from Romeo and Juliet at parting. It's not just that they take large leaps and twists and turns, though they are tonal, and what I mean by that is that they fit into major and minor scales and chord progressions that all of us are used to hearing from having lived in Western music. But he always arrives at consonants through the detours of meaningful dissonance and notes that sound wrong but are actually so right. It adds to the journey of the character. It adds weight and emotion to their experience as he reveals it in music. Finally, at the end of that movement, Juliet's left alone, and she is perhaps contemplating what could happen next. And in that moment, over pulsating woodwind sounds and pizzicato strings, we hear the fate theme. And it's played again, it's a melodic line in the very lowest basses in tuba, and it represents what's to come. Here it is. Juliet. You probably remember that Friar Lawrence has a plan, which is that Juliet takes a potion to simulate death, and then Romeo is able to meet her, and they can go off and live happily ever after. But Romeo doesn't get the message. And in this moment, the family is grieving, and Romeo enters after them, and I won't play it for you. It's a singular event, but that fate theme is wrenching when it's heard as a form of grief. And in fact, Prokofiev captures passion and grief in ways that words cannot, and even motion and visual conveyance cannot. It's just absolutely extraordinary music, and this is only one of three suites from the ballet. So any chance you get to see this ballet or hear the rest of the music, I strongly urge you to take it in. We've certainly had a great time learning it and bringing it together. And even more than that, we've had the extraordinary pleasure of meeting and working with Austin Huntington, who I think is, are you hiding back there, Austin? Are you there yet? Yay, come on out. This is Austin Huntington, everybody. How are you this evening?
I'm good.
So we get to play Dvorak together. First of all, I just haven't worked with very many musicians who are as exceptionally open and phenomenally normal as you are, Austin.
Well, thank you.
I mean, I don't.
I can say the same.
I mean that in the best possible way. You know, it's just, it's extremely easy to work with you, and you bring out the best in all of us, and we're thrilled to have you with us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Me too. I'm thrilled to be here.
Good. Yeah, you've had, when a guest artist comes to play with us here in Livermore, because we rehearse on a Tuesday and a Thursday and a Saturday, we get him for a whole week, almost. So he's already been to San Francisco, and you should tell them about the new barbecue place. They probably don't even
know. My wonderful host, Trey.
Here? There he is.
And so we went to this amazing barbecue place. It's a New Orleans-style barbecue called Backyard Bayou at Bayou. And they're not technically open yet. It's a soft opening, so everything's still like in the works. And some of the stuff wasn't even on the menu, but it was highly recommended. The couple of places that I went in Livermore was one of the best.
Excellent. So let me ask you just a little bit about you before we talk about Dvorak. So you have, I don't know if you've read your program yet, but Austin is, you're 21, right? Haven't yet finished his bachelor's degree and has been auditioning all over the country. And as you'll read, he's already a competition winner many times over and has performed fairly regularly out here in the Bay Area with some of our neighbor orchestras. And it has, thank God for the future of orchestral performances, been appointed the new principal cellist at the Indianapolis Symphony as of last spring. So he has a real job, ladies and gentlemen. He's not even out of bachelor's degree now. Exactly. And I know already from working with you that they are so lucky to have you because you're a people person, not just an excellent musician, but a good leader. So tell us a little bit, what is this experience like to still be finishing your degree and starting your job all at the same time?
Well, it's definitely it's a handful. I was able to work out with the orchestra. They wanted me to start right away in I got the job officially in June, and so they wanted me just to kind of initially, the management wanted me to start right away and not get my degree. But then the orchestra personnel manager at the orchestra, who's also one of the trombonists, just recently got his degree, even though he's in his 50s, because he did the same thing. He got his job when he was 20, and he always regretted not getting his degree because you can't teach anywhere. And it's almost like that like sentence that's left unfinished. And so I was able to work out with the orchestra. I doubled up on my classes and finished two semesters worth of classes in one semester. And then I started full-time in January, and once a month, I was lucky enough to negotiate a few extra vacation weeks here and there. And once a month, I fly back to Los Angeles to finish my degree and to have lessons with my teacher, who many consider to be the best principal cellist of the 20th century. And so it's very nice just to kind of have your firm footing and go back and play for one of your biggest mentors. So.
That's Ron Leonard, who he's speaking of.
Yeah, so, and for those of you who don't know, the job of a principal cellist is enormous. It's kind of like being the concertmaster of the cello section. And you are responsible for all the bowings, that, you know, which way are we gonna move the bow on each phrasing change, and any solos that come up, they're all yours, and I'm sure you'll be soloing with the orchestra on a semi-regular basis as well. We'll all have to fly up.
If they keep bugging me.
Southwest Airlines, here we come.
unofficial airlines of Indianapolis.
I haven't asked you an obvious question, which when we were in the car, I should have asked. Why did you pick the cello? What about the cello spoke to you, and when did you start?
Well, I started the cello when I was 4 years old. At four, I wanted to play the bass, the double bass, which is all the way over there, actually. There's one there, so you can see the size. And if you imagine a four-year-old, right, standing next to the bass, I could practically, like, go fit through the front of it and sit on the inside of it. But, my parents, while they weren't classical musicians, they at one point played classical music and instruments, and they were always big supporters, and we would always go, we lived in Michigan, and so we'd drive up to see my grandparents and go see the Grand Rapids Symphony or Berrien Springs Philharmonic or one of the smaller orchestras. And so at one of those family concerts, it's meant to bring your kids and to introduce the instruments to your kids as maybe you want to play, or at least give some education. And so my brother, who's also a violinist but more recently out in New York, he was already playing violin, and so being the younger brother I am, I looked up to him, but I also wanted to kind of have this like sibling rivalry kind of thing. And so I wanted to play an instrument, but I wanted to be a better instrument than his. So he's playing this little violin, and it's like, that's cool, but I want the biggest instrument I can get. And so I went with the bass because, I mean, tuba is cool, but the bass is just like, to look at it, it's already impressive. And so I pointed to that, and I was like, I want to play that. Like, that's my instrument that I want to play. My parents kind of like looked at each other and was like, well, that's a great instrument, but if you want to go that way, why don't you look at the cello? Because they know the cello, you can start when you're four, and you have to wait a while until you're... So I don't think they make bases small enough for
you have to stand on something.
Yeah.
Really, yeah, that would be tough. I don't think they make petite basses for
no, even a cello. Even a cello, one of the cellos that we were looking at literally was almost like a viola with a chopstick. it wasn't exactly the fanciest, but so anyways, that's why I play the cello, because I am a failed bass player.
Right.
But I still, it's funny, I still, every piece that I love consistently has a really awesome cello and bass part where they're playing, like Strauss, Glenn, Haldenleben, pretty much all Strauss, Mahler, it all has very important bass parts. And so I think that's part of the reason why I love it so much, is because I had that initial instinct that I love the bass, so.
And you picked the right clef to start as well.
Yeah.
So you were just talking about pieces you love. This is a concerto that you've played before. Early on, like when you, how old were you when you first learned this concerto?
I was 12 when I first learned this concerto.
Okay.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about your relationship to this piece, or what brings it home for you?
Well, when I first learned it, the first movement is the one that's the truly famous movement. It's the one that's, the main reason why I learned this piece was for competitions, because it's one of those pieces where it starts off strong and heroic, goes super sweet, and shows a lot of virtuosic. There's this one page, pardon my French, but my teacher calls it the page from hell, because it starts off just like with these fingered sticks, which is just going up and down the cello, and then just all the technique that you can imagine on the cello you have to do in that one page. And so it's a very virtuosic piece, and very sweet and sorrowful, and all that, like, it encompasses the whole spectrum in the first movement. And so I learned the first movement throughout a number of years, and by the time I got to the second and third, I thought I already basically played the whole piece, like, in the first movement. And so I tried to negotiate with my teacher, like, am I allowed to just, like, play this for you in a lesson and then move on to the next concerto? But he made me play each movement in each competition, because he said the movements get better and better. First movement's great, the second movement is absolutely gorgeous, and I know Laura will talk about another part, a very special part in the second movement soon. And then the third movement is almost like those two movements combined, and there's actually, I don't know if it's in the program notes or not, but there's a funny story, not funny, but just kind of like, it's very interesting, it makes you kind of turn your head. Dvorak was madly in love with his sister-in-law, Josephine, who was his wife's sister, which is complicated in itself. But then he was madly in love with her. He had just moved to America from Bohemia, his hometown, or his home country. And so he was madly in love with his sister, who's still living there. And so he had both homesickness and love that he can't have. Anywho, this is when he's writing the concerto. And he gets to the first room and everything's peachy. But then in the second room, he hears that his sister-in-law is very, very sick, and they don't know if she's going to survive. And so then he adds in this lovely theme. It's a G minor. It comes in this drastic G minor section. And it's called Leave Me Alone. And it's one of Josephine's favorite songs that Dvorak had written. So he adds that in and continues composing, and almost as like a way, like a homage to her, and to kind of just like how much he loves her. And then in the last movement, there was some debate. The cellist he was writing it for wanted a cadenza, super virtuosic, very standard, like ending super triumphantly on like a 5-1, whatever, like nothing super special. But then Josefina passed away, and he had gotten word of this, and he was heartbroken. And so he completely, like, even if he was considering that plan in the beginning, he completely scrapped that idea and ended up going with this very, very different section. You'll hear a drastic change. You hear the cello like going at it like virtuosically, and then suddenly you hear this beautiful brass chorale, and that signals the end of the piece and the part that he was most moved by, Josefina. And so you'll hear this Leave Me Alone theme come back again in between the concertmaster and me. And at one point it's played at the same time, which is almost as if he's saying, we should be together, because the part that I'm playing, the cellist is playing, is almost like Dvorak's heroic theme, and Josephine's theme is being played by the concertmaster, and this is the first time that it's played together. And so it moves on, and the theme keeps growing and developing. And finally, at the very end, you can hear the theme being played once again, and the cello getting softer and softer, but just the first fragment being repeated, almost as if it's somebody who's dying, their last words that are trying to say, but they don't have the energy to say it. And right after that section finishes, you hear the orchestra, the cello settles on a note, and you hear the orchestra with like this bump, 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 which is like the heartbeat, and it gets slower and slower and finally stops, and the cello's left completely bare, where the cello, like, then it almost has this huge, like, uplifting crescendo where the orchestra just takes over. And so that, of course, is Dvorak's symbolism, possibly of Josefina passing away and her spirit going up to heaven or to an afterlife or whatever he believed in. This spirit is now at peace, and everything, while it's not a happy ending, it's as happy as it could be. So that's the short version.
I went in talking over this with Austin, I went searching and found this song
I can't possibly say that in Czech the words. I wish I could. But this is the beginning of the song "Leave Me Alone" is how it translates. That is quoted throughout the second movement, and then this, I'll play you the part where he brings it back in the third movement. So here is the song that he refers to in honor of, in homage to Josefina. Break before the concert, but I really want to thank you, Austin, for joining us and for being with us.